Lee, the government owns 50.1% of the partnership and we own 49.9%. The government also owns a refinery on the island of Trinidad, and exercising their majority interest, they have directed that that crude oil is to be supplied to their refinery for supplying their on-island needs. So we have never had, and never in the future, for all practical purposes, will have access to that crude oil. With respect to the possible expansion of our refinery, this is a project that we started working on in November of 1981. We did quite a bit of research on projected market growth in the state of Alaska to try to determine the size that we might go to. We tried to determine the kind of product mix that might be needed in the state in terms of diesel or turbine fuel or gasoline. And on the basis of that, started doing the preliminary engineering for putting together a plant initially thought to be possibly at 70,000 barrels a day. That would be large in this market. It would be planning for like 1995, 1998 type of demands in the state. It is possible that we may settle out on a smaller capacity, something in the range of 55 or 60,000 barrels a day. We simply don't know yet. One of the key elements in our decision was what happens to the Royalty Board recommendations during this proceeding. Obviously, if Doyon were to build a refinery in Fairbanks and build the capacity to market gasoline there, because it costs us 8 or 9 cents a gallon to rail car gasoline from Anchorage to Fairbanks, we would be effectively stopped from penetrating that market. We would probably lose the interior market to Doyon, as has been the case with the diesel fuel and turbine fuel that's manufactured by North Pole Refining. So what happens here is of critical importance to us in determining what kind of plant and the capacity of that plant that we build at Kenai. The other fact is that we have been trying to determine, as Mr. Haynes has pointed out, what to do about the bottom of the barrel, the residual fuel. All forecasts indicate that the West Coast Utilities, who is the largest single user of residual fuel, are going to have abundant supplies of natural gas. They'll have coal-powered electricity wheeled over from Arizona. Their nuclear programs may or may not come on stream, but will make some contribution. All of those things have to be taken into consideration. Once you've done that, then you try to analyze what you do with that residual fuel. In our case, our decision is that we will probably have to destroy it in some fashion. We will either have to make petroleum coke out of it, or we will have to use a process, a hydrogenation process, that would convert it into additional turbine fuel and gasoline and diesel. We are currently running pilot plant operations on feedstock streams from our refinery to make that decision. Union Oil Research is the licensor of our first hydrocracker at Kenai. We're working with them as a potential licensor for the second one that would have to be built. We've engaged people like Dravo, who are materials handling specialists, to go to Kenai and do preliminary engineering on coke handling requirements, which incidentally are quite stringent and quite costly to operate in this environment, to deal with the moisture content of coke that you have to deal with in the process of manufacturing. We have therefore made no decision yet on which processes we should choose to enter into and which we should choose to build. Concurrently, our corporate finance group is meeting with financial institutions and banks to determine the form of and the best way and the most efficient way to handle the financing of the expansion project. All of these things probably will start coming together, and some decisions will be made sometimes within this year. One of the obligations under our contract is to report to the Commissioner of Natural Resources from time to time on the progress of our evaluation and planning and development. This proposed ANS contract, as I say, will remove a lot of the vulnerability that we face now and will, I think, keep us a formidable competitor in the state. Besides the product that we market through our own branded dealers, jobbers, and service stations, we are a large supplier to the other marketers in the state of Alaska. And as such, we think we save them transportation costs they would otherwise incur, thereby permitting them to market unfortunately competitive with us. We hope to become, or hope to continue to be, a formidable competitive force in the marketplace. I would say that there's a difference between ourselves and the other proposals that were received, and as has been our tradition all along, is that we're not proposing to do something in the future. We have done it. We are doing it. We built a $60 million hydrocracker reformer complex that was completed last year without anything except verbal encouragement from the state, from the administration, that go ahead and do it, because the state is not going to let you hang out on the line if you really need some help. We encourage you to do it. We need the jobs. We want the tax base. We want all the things that that kind of development will bring. And we have done it. So we're not asking for something to be done in the future, no pie in the sky. It's there, it's being done, and if we do the modification expansion that we're talking about, we're simply going to do it because it's a good, economically viable project, not because it gives us an opportunity to get crude oil, or not because of some subsidy that might be available to us. We don't believe that if a project is not viable on its own merits, that creating a subsidy for it will do nothing for its long-term viability. As a matter of fact, you simply give it crutches and make it weaker and unable to compete in a competitive environment. We are in a competitive environment today, and many people who have not been in the business very long have forgotten how to live and operate in this environment. I think that Tesoro Alaska's record for integrity in its business dealings with the state of Alaska and the performance on the contract that it had with the state is a record that is totally unblemished, and it's our obligation and our intention to maintain that unblemished record in the dealings with the state on this contract and anything that may emerge from it. Thank you.
Dennis, we heard yesterday that there could be anywhere from a 1 to 3 bucks a barrel. Could be now, with the way the markets run, et cetera. If you have this long-term contract that has some security of not having to mess with other governments and some type of security of having a source of supply, will there be any chance of that being reflected so that the people who stay at the pump, so that the people who stay see this reflection and know you're here?
Well, I think you would probably either think me a fool or a liar if I pretended to say that I knew what prices in the future might be, because there are almost an imponderable number of variables that affect price, not the least of which, of course, is the cost of the raw material. But that is only one factor: the cost of manufacturing, the price escalation of our natural gas that we use for refinery fuel, labor cost increases, and of course, the most important of all, competition. What does competition do to pricing? So to say that if you lower my cost of crude a dollar, that the price at the pump will drop a dollar.
Oh, I wouldn't.
No one can really, in all honesty, project that. I think what it would do for us is, as I mentioned, there are times in the past where we have materially had to reduce run during the real tight market and the very expensive market of 79.80, we had cut back runs to about 38,000 barrels a day. Not that there wasn't any crude. Crude shortages are really economic shortages, not absolute shortages. If you wanted to pay $100 a barrel during the peak of the crisis, you could have bought a barrel of crude. But it doesn't mean that you could have refined it and profitably sold the product from it. So what we see this as having a tendency to do is mitigate the abrupt price movements that occur in shortages and give us an opportunity to remain competitive in the marketplace and not lose our competitive position. If our crude cost goes up extraordinary and we try to pass it through by holding prices higher than competition, we'll soon be out of business. People will simply not buy from you if you're consistently higher than your competitors. Currently, we are very competitive on our pricing. In most cases, we're below our competitors and like to stay there, because that gives us the advantage that we need to penetrate new markets that we're not into. That's the only way you can penetrate a new market, is to lower the cost. quality certainly is a factor, but when you get right down to it, price is the main determinant in buying or selling petroleum products, even on the streets. I didn't perhaps answer your question fully, but I say it. I don't think anyone, any reasonable person would try to, he shouldn't, because he simply cannot know all the imponderables to say that an X reduction in price will yield a X reduction or a percentage of X reduction in the selling price on the street. I simply couldn't know that.
But as I understand your answer, then you're saying that you will do whatever you can to stay competitive or below competitive prices.
Absolutely. Our intention is to grow. We're not content with being a 48,000 barrel day refiner. We'd like to be a 100,000 barrel day refiner if the market will let us.
Dennis, in your gasoline marketing, what percentage do you sell to other suppliers? In other words, how much of the gasoline goes to Soro and Union, and not to Soro, but Texaco and Union?
This is a public record from the state tax reports, and which we monitor to see what our market penetration is, and we currently have somewhere between 25% to 27% of the market. The Soro Alaska does direct. That would indicate that the remainder is supplied to people like Chevron and Union and Texaco and independent jobbers and distributors who don't market under our brand or don't market our product directly. As I mentioned, we have the capacity to supply the total requirement in the state, but from a practical purpose, probably never will. The reason for that is here in the Southeast, for example, this market can be more competitively supplied from refiners in the Puget Sound area than it can by us hauling product by barge back around from Kenai. So of the total market, we simply can't capture it unless we can break the code on transportation costs to find out a way to get it down here competitively with those Northeast refineries, Northwest refineries. The same with diesel fuel. As I mentioned before, North Pole Refinery has essentially captured the interior market. There's no way I can penetrate that paying the kind of transportation costs I've got to pay to get it from Anchorage to Fairbanks. In terms of the market we serve, which is the lower rail belt, Anchorage area, Kenai Peninsula area, as an example, we supply about 75% of the aviation turbine fuel used at the Anchorage International Airport, which is a very substantial percentage. The fact that we don't supply 100% of it, either direct or through a Texaco or Chevron, is one of the driving forces to build a unit at the refinery that makes more turbine fuel, simply because there's a vacuum that must be supplied either by North Pole hauling product down from Fairbanks at great cost to them, or people actually importing product from the lower 48 or from offshore to Alaska. So there's still a market vacuum in turbine fuel that we desire to fill, and we're nearest to that deficiency, and it's logical that it would make good economic sense for us to do it.
The point that I was trying to make is that you do sell the raw gasoline to the other companies, and they then put their additives in it and market it.
Right.
One thing that's been brought up is the potential loss to the state in royalty and severance because of the possible offset in the two-tier pricing system of West Coast to Gulf Coast. I wonder if you could respond to that. That's something that I think some people might consider to be a subsidy, although you actually pay the average price that anyone else pays, there at least could be some reduction in revenue to the state, and I wonder if there's also another side of that question.
Yes, there's a multitude of sides to it. As Commissioner Katz yesterday explained, and Mr. Haynes did, Commissioner Haynes did, the penalty that they've illustrated of $10 million is representative of the market value that exists at a point in time, and this may be representative of market values that exist at this point in time. However, as they also explained, that's simply selecting somewhat arbitrarily a point and saying this is the way it's going to be forever. That is not the way necessarily that it is going to be forever. traditionally, Gulf Coast prices have been higher than West Coast prices. In glut conditions and surplus conditions, prices tend to float around an equalized basis, especially since decontrol and the fact that U.S. crude prices and world crude prices are establishing a somewhat equilibrium level. You could go back in time and analyze over a period of 10 years and probably discover that there were periods in the past where the differential was the opposite of what was presented yesterday, and that there might be a significant benefit accruing from shipping to the Gulf Coast versus shipping to the West Coast. So you've got a package of numbers, and you can almost make any kind of projection that you in your own mind think is the most reasonable projection for the future, and come up perhaps with a penalty, and come up perhaps with no penalty, or come up with a benefit. I don't venture to say again that I can forecast the future and know what the future price might be of oil or what the relationship might be of that oil. I have no way to tell whether a barrel that we would take and trade would displace a West Coast barrel or would displace a Gulf Coast barrel. Obviously, if it displaced the Gulf Coast barrel, it would have a profit impact rather than a positive rather than a negative impact. In the expansion that we just completed, we added somewhere in the range of 20 or 21 new employees in the refinery and four or five professional people, chemical and mechanical engineers, and several staff members. Our employees make, top people in the refinery making the magnitude of $40,000 to $45,000 a year or more. And the lower level ones make 18 to 20, and the average might be 35. So we've got roughly $1 million payroll that we've added. If you use the old Chamber of Commerce multiplier of 5 to 1, we've added $5 million worth of benefit to the community through the expansion we just completed, notwithstanding the tax base that's created by a $60 million improvement added to the refinery. So I presume the commissioner, in going through his exercises, will be able to document these things as far as the trade-off is concerned. But notwithstanding those trade-offs, trying to project the future market values on the Gulf Coast or the East Coast or the West Coast or the price FOB Valdez is something that you simply can't do. If you told me in 1979, 1980, and we were a victim of our lack of foresight, we bid in the auction on the ANS royalty crude, and we got an award at a premium of $1.91 a barrel over the in-value price. As it turned out, about the time delivery started a few months later, the market had fallen, and we could have bought that same oil in the spot market for $4 or $5 a barrel less. But we didn't. We had a contract with the state, which we performed against, and we paid $1.91 premium. Now, the state was the beneficiary in its treasury to that extent, but our customers suffered a penalty because they could have been buying gasoline and diesel cheaper because we did not have the opportunity to buy the spot market oil to lower the cost of crude and was stuck with the higher priced oil. Conversely, had you told me then that there would have been a drop in the magnitude of the drop that's occurred, that today you could buy North Coast crude delivered to the Gulf Coast for $26 a barrel, I would have told you then you're equally crazy. So it's just almost impossible in the kind of world that exists today to try to forecast what it might be.
But basically, even at the worst case of West Coast displacement, your net benefit to the state substantially exceeds that worst case. And if, for example, we had an import tariff or some stabilization in the world market, which has got to happen at some point, I don't think we look at a 12-year contract period and can assume that we're going to be in the kind of situation we are now.
Exactly.
Production has to go down, and prices probably got to adjust somewhere along the way. At that point, then the differential between West Coast and Gulf Coast isn't going to be there, and that loss isn't going to be there, or that potential loss isn't going to be there. But the benefit, which exceeds the maximum loss, is going to be there throughout the entire period.
Yes. We share that feeling, incidentally. Obviously, we would not be here attempting to get a long-term supply of crude if our attitude was that crude supplies will remain abundant and weak forever. In doing the research, research for our project, we engaged several consultants, one of whom incidentally does some work for the state of Alaska, Walter Levy and Company, and asked him to give us his projection of worldwide crude supply and demand balances. And his conclusion was that there will be periods of surplus and periods of shortage, but the periods of shortage would probably be more frequent and of greater amplitude in price movement than would the periods of depression and surplus. And I think that's somewhat the conventional wisdom of the people that are knowledgeable in petroleum economics, and it's on that basis that we feel it's critical that we have contractors support us.
We've got about 10 minutes
of
session. Does anyone have any last questions?
Why are you in such a different position compared to Doyon when we talk about return oil? You don't seem to be very concerned about it.
Well, I'm very concerned about it. We have a, through either foresight, I like to think it's through astute management, but it's probably more luck than anything else, entered into a contract with San Diego Gas and Electric.
Well, you've already told me.
We have been selling them since 1972, and we have renewed the contract on about a three-year rolling period. The contract that we have will expire in 1984. The fact that if residual fuel markets do not strengthen, as forecasts now indicate they won't, we've got the same problem they've got, and our solution to that problem is to convert the refinery to process that bottom of the barrel into something else. We don't have access to Trans-Alaska Pipeline to serve as a place to physically put it, a guaranteed market. You may not like the price, but at least you've got a guaranteed market.
I didn't realize you had a contract right now. I just had one other quick question. If you were to purchase from one of the other producers today, wouldn't you have to pay more than the average wage price?
Jim, you want to respond to that? I imagine Jim is president of our crude oil company, and if I may.
Well, I think that that all depends on which day that we have tried to cover that contract. If today we were buying, and it would depend on the willingness of the producer to sell to us when we do this short-term and long-term basis, which the latter is something a viable opportunity. But we in fact are buying today as spot crude oil, AMS crude oil, from Ohio. And the price that we pay to Ohio is higher than what we probably could buy from either ARCO or Exxon, but they've been in their netback price to us from station one, but they weren't willing to sell to us at that time. So, I think the exhibits of the price relative to Ohio show that they are always, in most every case, has been a higher price seller, a higher net back substation on anyone else. So I suspect that we're paying a higher price today from Ohio than we would pay from some of the other suppliers.
What about in relation to the average weighted price?
Well, by virtue of having the highest price and having a high volume of oil in the average, their price would be higher than the weighted average price.
If we haven't got any further questions, we're all going to have to go to the respective session. We thank you very much, and I hope DNR will be getting some more information back to us, and we'll be dealing with this in respective housing.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you.